There are events in the Old Testament that are described by some as biblical myths. One of those alleged myths is the story of Noah's Ark in Genesis chapters 6 through 9. We teach Noah's story to our young children, and they readily accept its reality. But as we mature, some begin to doubt the spectacular claims of the flood or the flood story. Maybe it's really an allegory or just figurative language. Do you have misgivings about the story of Noah? Let's talk about it today on this episode of Craving Answers, Craving God. I'm Chuck Rathert with Aaron Miller. Aaron is the pastor of St. James Lutheran Church in Glen Carbon, Illinois. Aaron, whether it's the story of Noah's Ark, or the parting of the Red Sea, or the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, there are many narratives in the Old Testament that are difficult to believe. Are they all true, or are some in fact figurative, or are some purely mythical?
It's kind of the wrong question to start off with.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
It's a swing and a miss.
No, it's a good question, but it's the wrong first question. The first question is, what do the stories mean? What's happening in the story of the Bible that those stories are a major part of? Without delving into that, because I'm sure we're going to, I'll say that that's the— well, let me tell you why I say it's not the important first question. It's about 150 years ago, 200 years ago, people in the West started to say, oh, these old stories, religious stories from the ancient world, they're all mythical. You can't really trust them. We all know now that the Red Sea didn't really part, that God didn't really create the world out of nothing, that the world wasn't entirely flooded with water. And we know that those aren't true. Christians responded by saying, no, they are true. And let's demonstrate why they're true. You have scientific reasons for thinking that these things didn't happen. We can come up with scientific reasons for why we think that they did happen. And there, now we've shown you, and we think they're true. And okay, there's a place for that, but Christians, and my type of Christian too, assumed that that was now our main job, was to demonstrate that the Bible is true, to try and figure out a way to prove that the Bible is true. That's the least interesting fact about the Bible, is its truth. It's one thing to say it's true, but if you're not actually reading the story—
Say that again.
See, this is hard for us. It's hard for us, is that—
The least important thing is that it's true? Is that what you said?
The least interesting thing
least
about
interesting?
It, I said, is okay. That it's true. We just assume now, Christians in the United States assume that, well, the important fact about the Bible is its truth. And then they don't read it. They don't stop and say, what is the flood all about in the story? I agree that it's true. I believe that it's true. But what's most important is, what is it doing in the story? What is it doing here? Why did it happen? Why are we told about it? How does it function in the story? I'm not saying, and I know we're going to talk about this, there's definitely a place to talk about, is it true? What's the evidence for it? But it's the least interesting thing about it. Now, all that to say, now that I've said that, I'll say this. There are lots of things that happen, and this is a response to those who would say, oh, we can't believe big, huge cosmic events, the world being created out of nothing, a global flood. We can't believe those nowadays with our, with what we know about, we're all smart now. We have all the science and test tubes and whatnot, microscopes. We all know that this can't happen. There are lots of things that have happened within recent memory that, if they had been recorded in the Bible or in the Enuma Elish or in the Polycanon or in some ancient document, moderns would say, oh, that's bogus. We can't believe stuff like that. Lots of things that have happened. The Tunguska event in was either the Soviet Union or it was right before the Soviet Union in Russia, over a little bit over 100 years ago, a comet explodes just several miles. It enters the Earth's atmosphere and explodes several miles above the ground, wipes out hundreds of square miles of trees, flattens them in a radial pattern from the center. It created a sonic boom and an explosion that could be heard on every single continent. It could be heard in the United States. It could be heard in Europe. If the Bible told a story about this huge boom that could be heard all over the world, contemporary people would say, oh, just them old superstitious people making up myths. If the Bible had told stories about global pandemics, superstitious myths, you know. But we know that they happen. We know about the Black Death. We know about the Spanish flu. We know by now about COVID. If the Bible had told a story about a cosmic war that took place on all continents with massive armies and navies and people in flying machines flying around shooting at each other, modern people would say, oh, it's clearly superstitious myth made up. But we believe it because we have seen it. And the stories that you see in the Bible, I'm not saying that they're all, very simply believed. Lots of crazy things happen in the Bible. It's just a matter of, do they fit in with the story that you live in? That's the question. World War II, the Second World War, fits in with the story that I live in. My grandfather fought in it. He told me stories about it. There's political ramifications even today, going back to that point. The Russia and Ukraine war, for instance, can be explained to some extent by things that happened during the Second World War. It's easy for me to believe in. It's just a question of which story do you live in. And I freely admit that I don't have a lot of scientific knowledge. I can't tell you about geological strata and the effects that a global flood would have had on the Earth's atmosphere that can be examined or not examined now. I don't know. I just know that people believe stories that match up with the story that they're currently living in. Everybody does that. And so for me, living in the story of the world as told by sacred scripture, it's not hard for me to believe in it.
So let's go back to your original point where you said that as far as these stories are concerned, the real question is, what do the stories mean? I think that's the way you said it.
Yeah.
My simple mind clicks on that and says, well, it must be kind of like Aesop's fables. He wrote a bunch of stories.
Right.
And they meant something. They taught some kind of moral integrity. But they weren't true. He made them up.
Right, yeah.
So the fables are figurative. And I'm about to come to the conclusion that you just convinced me that the Old Testament historical biblical narratives are also made up.
Yeah, so if the goal of the storyteller is to present some sort of timeless truth, frequently fiction does a great job of that. Aesop's fables is a good example of that, like you mentioned. Honestly, Jesus's parables, some of his parables are designed to tell, now there's debate about this, but some of his parables are designed to tell big picture truths. And Jesus doesn't have any problem using fiction to do that. However, what we're talking, when I say, you know, what is the, we're talking about the flood here. What does the flood mean? What I mean by that is, what is God intending to do with the creation that he made? What does that mean? Like, what are God's purposes for his creation? What does the flood tell us about that? I'm not saying that it didn't happen, but I'm saying the main question is, what is God trying to accomplish in the story that he's writing about how he's dealing with his creation? And it's fairly easy if you read the story of the cosmic flood in Genesis 6 through 9 that you can suss out there exactly what it is that he's up to, what he's trying to do, what his goals are, what his intentions are at the beginning of it, what his intentions are flowing out of it, no pun intended, in his plans going forward. He says as much, and that's the interesting thing. Why would a God create a beautiful world and then destroy it with water, rescuing just a few people? Why would he do that? And what does that mean for us now in our we're living in several chapters on from that story. Several is an understatement. How do we fit into that story? Now, that's the interesting thing for me.
So what if I'm dubious about your God and sort of pulling on the same thread that you just introduced there? As I think about a worldwide flood and the calamity that is described there, this would be an epic movie. It is almost beyond belief. And if this is the way God does things, I'm more inclined to doubt your God than I was before, giving us stories that are just beyond our ability to explain or grasp. They're just off the chart. You could work at it all day. And if you come at it from that prove it to me kind of perspective, you're not going to arrive. So now I've looked at the story, and you know what? It's made me doubt him more.
Right.
What are you going to do with that?
I would say if you're looking for a God who does things and only does things that make sense to you, then you're basically, just go look in the mirror. If that's what you want, is somebody that you can believe in that makes sense to you, you're pretty much limited to a small amount of persons. If God is God, so I was having a conversation this past week with a woman whose grown son has stepped away from Christianity, and one of the reasons he tells her is because the whole Trinity thing is just made up nonsense. He can't understand it. And what I'd like to say to him is, I can't make the Trinity make sense to you. But if God exists, you should anticipate that at least some things about him are going to be too big to fit in your head. That's what God is. He's bigger than us. If not, if he's smaller than me, if he's small enough to fit in my head, then I'm stronger than him. If I can comprehend him, then I'm greater than him. And I can't even comprehend myself or my kids. What right do I have to say, I won't believe in God unless I can understand him? I can't even understand myself. And so if God does things that are bigger than we can comprehend, that's just par for the course. If God does things and we're like, oh, that's mean. I can't believe in a God who would do something cruel, like destroy the world with a flood. Again, that's not the point. The point isn't, I can only believe in a God who is as nice as I am. Well, that's not God. That's me. If whoever God is, he's going to be different than me, and he's going to be stronger than me, and he's going to be too incomprehensible for me, and he's going to do things that I don't understand. That shouldn't hold anybody back. This doesn't answer questions about why would God do something like this. It doesn't answer those questions. But what I am trying to cut off before we get there is this notion that I can only believe in a God who is comprehensible to me morally, cosmically, ontologically. That's just not God then.
So I'm a Christian. I read my Bible. Well, mostly I read the New Testament. Because when I go back into the Old Testament, Jonah being swallowed by a big fish in there for 3 days and three nights, doesn't come out dead, doesn't come out bleached white. I just stay away from that stuff. It troubles me more than it encourages me. But I'm a Christian. What would you say to me?
Well, I'd say, again, if you try to slim God down to the comprehensible or to the understandable, then you're really... you're cutting him down, you're whittling him down so that he's more like me or you. I would just say embrace it. There's more stuff. One of the things that postmodernism has done really beneficial is to say modernism, this scientific notion that if we can't prove it, if it won't fit into our test tubes, unless 4 out of 5 scientists recommend the story of the flood to me, I will not believe it. That sort of nonsense is, it's ethnocentric. It's very much we smart people here in Northern Europe and in North America are smarter than everybody else throughout the rest of human history. I would say just stay away from those sorts of things. There are more things in heaven and earth than your philosophy can grasp, Horatio, to quote Shakespeare. I mean, just like there's too much stuff to fit into our heads. It used to be said like 200 years ago, well, we all know the flood is mythological. could never have happened. But then we started to see that, well, actually the Chinese, the ancient Chinese have a cosmic flood myth. The Mesopotamians do. We have this in the Enuma Elish. We have this in the Epic of Gilgamesh. The Cheyenne do. In the high plains of North America, the Cheyennes have an ancient flood myth. Many people in Africa, many groups in Africa have an ancient flood myth. Where did this come from? Is this just coincidence that all these people in their collective memory have an ancient flood myth? Well, now some white guy sitting in an office at a university in Northern Europe tells me I can't believe in the flood because it's not civilized. You know, it's not respectable. It's not scientific. I'll just say, well, I think that you probably have a slimmed down worldview. Your worldview is very, very, it's about 100, 200, 250, 300 years old, and it's located to one particular location on the globe. And the story of the cosmic flood is thousands and thousands and thousands of years old and appears everywhere all over the globe. Who should I go with? You, Mr. Smart Guy, or with everybody else? And all I'm saying is, this doesn't, again, it doesn't prove anything. To say you have to prove it to believe it would be to cave into his standards, Mr. Smart Guy sitting in the university. And I'm just saying, like, just look out the whole world. The world is a much bigger place than we've imagined in North America the past couple hundred years. It's possible that stuff like this could happen that we can't understand, but it's still true.
So I'm a Christian. You say to me, do you believe Jesus changed water into wine? I say, yes, sir. You say to me, do you believe Jesus fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish? I say, yes, sir. You say to me, do you believe Jesus rose from the dead after being dead for 3 days? I say, yes, sir. And you say, do you believe in Noah's Ark? And I have trouble with that. That may sound kind of silly, but I think there are people who are right there at that point. They believe the stuff, the New Testament miracles, but really struggle with these Old Testament miracles. I guess it seems inconsistent, but don't you think there are people who are in that basket?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, one thing you could say is that, you know, you believe in Jesus, you believe that Jesus rose from the dead. That's a bit easier for me than Jonah and the whale, because Jonah and the whale is kind of a one-off story. Jesus rising from the dead, there's hundreds of witnesses to this. People who wrote the story down from their own perspective. We have 4 of these in the Christian Gospels. People who are willing to give up their lives for this. It's easier for me to say, there's pretty good historical evidence that something happened there. And more even skeptics are starting to say, something happened. I don't want to believe that, you know, God became a human being and rose from the dead, but something happened on that first Easter morning. I get it. Jonah and the whale is a little bit harder to grasp. One of the things I would say, though, is that, you know, you believe in Jesus. Jesus believed in Jonah and the whale. Jesus talked about it. He assumed it was a real story. He mentions it several times in the Gospels. So it's just a question of, like, how many impossible things are you willing to believe? You're willing to believe God became a human being and rose from the dead. What's stopping you from believing other stuff that's in the same story? I mean, this is different than, right? Okay, so let me just say, this is different than believing in the tooth fairy, right? I mean, because this is the same story. The story of a prophet, I'm talking about Jonah now. I know we're not talking about the flood, but this prophet being told, God has a mission for you to preach redemption and salvation to this people. And God is committed to this. And the prophet running away from it. And God forcing the prophet to go back to it by metaphorically killing him, by having him swallowed by a whale, and then spit up on a beach so that he has to do this mission of redemption. That's the same part of the story as the flood story. God commissioning his human creatures to live out redemption in the world, them running away from it. God killing his human creatures in a flood, but rescuing some so that they can be forced to continue on this mission. Jesus being put on this mission to rescue humanity, being assassinated by human beings, but being brought back to this mission by coming back out of death into life. It's a part of the same story. This is different than the tooth fairy. Like, I lost my tooth, so I'm going to get a dollar tonight. My mom and dad bring the dollar in, take the tooth, tell me the tooth fairy came. I don't have to believe in the tooth fairy. It's not a part of this story. It's, you know, it's a part of the story of a kid losing a tooth and getting a buck, and which is fine. We did it with our kids too, but it's a different story. It's different than, I can believe in Jonah and the whale. It's a part of this story. I can believe in the flood. It's a part of this story of God bringing redemption out of death. which is just fits in perfectly with God himself dying and rising from the dead.
Let's turn this coin over and come at it from the opposite angle. Let's say my friend doesn't believe that Noah's Ark happened. He believes it's a myth or a fable. Doesn't believe in any of those Red Sea stories or Jonah stories. And I tell him, well, I do. I believe in them all. And I can tell just by the look in his face that he's disappointed that I'm such an idiot. Maybe that's too strong a term, but you know what I mean. And then I say, you know, I and millions of other Christians regularly say out loud the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God the Father, Almighty God, maker of heaven and earth. If my God can make heaven and make earth, the Red Sea is a sideshow compared to the rest of that. So it's not hard for me to believe in any of these Old Testament stories. So we're done. We're done talking here. You know, take it or leave it. What do you think about that kind of an exchange?
It's fine. It's fine. Trying to tell some, you know, somebody says, I can't believe in the resurrection of Jesus. If I say, oh, well, I do. And that's the end of the story. Like, whatever. You know, what's happened there? Nothing. I disagree with you. You disagree with me. In person, we could be nice to each other. If this exchange was happening on Twitter, we'd probably say nasty things about each other. Nothing's really happening. And that's why I go back to my original point. To say that you believe that the cosmic flood of Genesis 6 through 9 happened, that's one thing. Okay, fine, great. What does it mean? What's the message there? The message, it's the same thing when somebody says to me, I can't believe in that Jesus rose from the dead. Okay, let me give you the proofs. There are no proofs, but I can say, I'll give you some proofs here. I'll give you some evidences at least. Okay, so what then? If the payout of the story of the resurrection, which is the same as the payout of the story of the flood, is that God cannot tolerate rebellion against himself, but he is still deeply and radically committed to rescuing his human beings, and he offers us free salvation. He's created a path for us to be rescued from certain destruction by his grace and by his love for us. If that's not where the conversation heads, then it doesn't do us any good to say, well, I think I can prove the Bible to you. If we don't tell them what the story of the Bible is that God loves them and is committed to rescuing them. And by turning to him, like Noah did, if by turning to him, like millions and billions of people have done, by turning to the God in Jesus Christ who died and rose from the dead, we can be rescued from the wrath to come, then we haven't really done our job. And that's why I say the most interesting part about these stories is what they mean, not that they're true. Although their truth is definitely important. It's just not the main thing. It's not the payout.
So let's say my friend, that the conversation continues, and my friend looks at me and in a kind of a condescending way and says, have you ever stopped to think how much food you would have on the ark to feed all those animals for 120 days? How much fresh water, because I guess if the whole earth was flooded, the water wouldn't be fresh. How much water it would take to keep all those animals taken. Have you ever considered how many shovels you'd need to clean out of the ark every day from the outcome of eating food every day? Have you ever thought about how much work it would take 8 people to do all this? In other words, a long string of realities that just make the story of the ark implausible.
Yeah.
Where would you go with that?
I would say, no, I've never thought about it. And honestly, I'm totally uninterested in it. I don't care. I honestly don't care how much crap Noah had to shovel out of the ark.
If you could answer that for me, maybe I could come in your direction. Yeah. And now you tell me you don't care.
I would say, go jump on YouTube and type in, how were the pyramids built? There are a gazillion videos, animations, great 3D animations of different theories about how the pyramids were built. You know, dirt mounds that were, you know, very, 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 very small slopes that leading up to it. I saw one just recently about water. It was flooded, and then the stones were lifted up via water. You know, people don't know. Nobody knows how the pyramids were built. How were those massive multi-ton stones lifted to that great height by people who had no modern construction equipment. Nobody knows. And yet, there's the pyramids. And if the pyramids weren't there, if somehow they had gotten destroyed in the past, I think they're probably about 5,000 to 6,000 years old, older than much of the actual writing in the Bible. Like they were probably, when Moses was in Egypt, the pyramids were probably 1,000 to 1,500 years old already, which is stunning. Like the oldest buildings in my town, my hometown, are like 150 years old. And here's Moses. We think of him as like, whoa, just incredibly ancient character. And these structures were there 2,000 years before he was there. If they weren't there, if they had been obliterated sometime in the past 1,000 years and people read ancient documents describing the pyramid, contemporary people would be like, they didn't exist because there was no way possible to build those things. I don't even ever think about how the pyramids were built. I don't care. They're there. It's not important to me. Like we can, it's this whole like myth. Again, it's this whole myth of like, well, we finally, us people in the West are smart. Finally, after thousands, tens of thousands, who knows how many millions of years, I don't know, that human beings have been around. We finally are the smart ones. And if we can't understand how they did it, they obviously didn't do it. Like Moses, no, it couldn't have built an ark because I don't understand how he could have done it. Have you ever thought about it? Couldn't have done it. It's impossible. I would just say, I don't think about that stuff. I just assume that they were just as smart as we are. I know that they didn't have microwave ovens. You know, I know they didn't have fuel injection in their cars, but they were smart too. And it would be very, very arrogant. Maybe even, you can say this to your friend, here's a trigger word. Maybe even it would be racist to pretend like us white people, if we can't understand it, they couldn't have done it. That's super arrogant. That's how I would say it to him.
I think you just lit that conversation up.
Yeah, it's not fair. It's playing unfair because you're loading it with all sorts of emotional content. But honestly, that's a little bit what's behind the modern movement is us European and our European descendants, our friends in Australia and North America, we'll include them too because they came from us. We finally have the truth. This stuff couldn't have happened in the ancient world. It's very, very arrogant. And so, no, I'm not interested in that. I would be entertained by a conversation where I turned it around on somebody and exposed their cultural arrogance. But outside of that, I have no difficulty in believing that people could have built a large boat to house tons of animals and could have come up with all kinds of ingenious ways to feed them and to dispose of their bodily waste. I have no problem believing that.
So let's continue with my friend here, and I want to bring in a hypothetical.
Your racist friend.
We apologize for that, friend. So I've stuck my flag right in Christian territory. I've placed my flag.
Yeah.
I believe that the Bible is true. I believe that it is inerrant from Genesis to Revelation. And if it says that Jonah got swallowed by a big fish and spit up 3 days later, then I believe that it's true. My friend is arguing from a sort of scientific perspective,
sure,
looking for data, looking for information to assemble and then come up with a proof of some kind, which may demonstrate that my faith is incorrect. But what's really going on, because I can't look inside his head or his heart, it could be that what's really going on is he's not so much interested in getting a proof. What he's interested in is not being accountable to the Almighty God that I have held forward. Because if he's accountable, then that's going to have some profound effects on some of the things he thinks and does in his own life. They might have to change. And the science is kind of a facade. That just keeps me at arm's length so that he doesn't have to enter into that territory. But what's really going on is he doesn't want to be convinced that there is a God to whom he is accountable. How often do you think that happens?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is this was discussed in the 19th century. By biologists who were tinkering around with these notions of modernism and the Enlightenment and what it meant. Not just biologists, but also philosophers, of course, they were on top of it more than the biologist even, like Nietzsche, who saw where this was headed. like what you guys are doing is you're crafting a world where God is not necessary. Like you're trying to think of what would a world look like without God. So miraculous stuff wouldn't happen. We can discount that. But really what the payout is if there's a world with no God, I can do what I want. Now I read several episodes ago, I read the quote by Aldous Huxley where he said, I went to college and a universe with meaning and purpose was standing in the way of my potential sexual exploits. So I quite simply just said, the world doesn't have meaning and purpose. There is no God. If there's no God, I get to do whatever I want. Because it's true that if there is a God who created the world, it's true what you're saying, Chuck, if there's a God who created the world, then I'm ultimately responsible to him. That means that there are rules about how he wants this to work.
Not just responsible, but accountable, which is a little bit more severe, I think.
Sure. And so a lot of this comes down to that. The scary thing about saying, I believe that Jesus rose from the dead is that that means that he's Lord of the universe and I'm not. And I lose personal sovereignty. I have to figure out what it is that he wants and needs from me and bow the knee to that. And so there is some of that going on. I too think that science as an ultimate meaning generator is a smokescreen. I mean, we all know, here's one way to say it. Well, I'll say it this way. Science is constantly changing. We all know that. And I don't just mean it's changing in little ways all the time. There's a funny video that I think Angela showed me a couple years ago of it's a couple who's sitting in a dining room that's clearly decorated in a 1960s style. And somebody busts in the door and they say, who are you? What are you doing in our house? And it's this guy. And he's like breathlessly like saying to them, hey, I'm from the 1990s and I'm here to tell you, you can't eat those eggs. Those eggs have cholesterol. You have to stop. Those eggs are going to kill you. And they're like, oh my word. And they push the eggs aside. And then it cuts to another shot where they're sitting in a 1970s era style dining room. And the same guy busts in and he says, whoa, hold up. I told you about the eggs. I was wrong. It's actually good cholesterol. You should eat those eggs. They're good for you. And then it goes on four or five times with all the differing opinions on whether eggs are good for you over the course of the past 20 years. And these are scientists who tell us this. And as they make new discoveries, they adjust what they think. Those are small things, let alone like 200 years ago. You know, 200 years ago, scientists, it was clear to them that Newtonian mechanics had solved all the interesting questions about causality in the universe. They had no clue that in 100 years, they were going to be absolutely obsolete in the academy once quantum theory and, you know, the theory of general and special relativity became the classroom standard, that everything they thought they knew about the way the universe worked changed. So to say, well, now science has proved that you're wrong. You know, science has proved that you're wrong. Oh man, you who subscribe to science, you will be obsolete. And this is appropriate because the more discoveries we make, the more we change. It's just totally the way that things should work. But this whole notion that like, well, I understand everything now and I can tell that everybody besides me is wrong who disagrees with me. That's a completely inappropriate use of science. And if we can get other people to see that like, no, there are paradigm shifts. It's okay. Keep an open mind. What you think you know might not be the case. You think that you know a global flood could never happen. But all of a sudden, we find these stories from the Cheyenne located in their oral tradition that describe this global flood. And I think it's worthwhile to stop and ask. People in North America experienced a global flood, they say, in their past. People in Europe, too. People in the Far East, too. People in Africa, too. Maybe it's possible that there was a global flood. Maybe it's possible that we should read the story of Noah and take it seriously that something like this could have happened. And maybe, to your point from your question, Chuck, maybe we should ask, if the story of Noah happened, what are the theological ramifications? Is there a God who could cause something like this to happen? Is there a God who could create goodness out of cosmic devastation. And what does that mean for what I believe about myself?
So let's sum up briefly here if we can. Go right back to where we started. The story of Noah and the Ark, the great flood, the eight people who survived that calamity. Is it history? Is it figurative or analogous? Or is it myth and fiction? For somebody who's listening to us right now who is not sure how to answer that question for him or herself, they're kind of wavering back and forth among those choices. What's your advice?
Well, so I'm not a fan of, and this is a technicality, and I know I'm fighting an uphill battle with the person on the street here. The word myth is not synonymous with fiction. The word myth has classically been understood as a foundational story. And what I want to argue, along with all Christian thinkers everywhere, is that the Bible is myth, but in a real historical sense. It is the myth come to life. It is the foundational story that's true. What I would say to somebody who's grappling with this is, you know, I know it's tempting to say, well, you believe in these ancient stories. You have this book that tells you what to think. That's very, very small-minded of you. Me, I'm objective. I'm open-minded. I think what I think. And I would just say, no, you have a book too. It's not written down like my book, maybe. It's the myth of the scientific revolution. It's the myth of modernism. But you have a book that you read too, that you subscribe to, and the foundational stories you believe in. The story of Newton and the apple hitting him on the head. The story of Darwin traveling around the Galapagos Islands, coming up with discoveries. The story of Einstein studying charts about how light bends. You have all these foundational stories too, and you believe them. They can't all be true. The story of the apple hitting Newton on the head and the story of Einstein looking at charts describing the bending of light tell different stories. What you're doing is you're looking at a story and you're coming up and you're trying to fit how you can live into the story. I'm just doing the same thing. It's a separate story, but I'm doing the same thing. I'm no more superstitious than you are. I'm no more beholden to a narrative than you are. I have my myths. You have your myths. Your myth of Darwin on the Galapagos Islands is no more supernatural. It's no more rational. It's no more hard to believe. It's no more easy to believe than my myth of the God who became a human being. We all have our stories that we read. Mine's different than yours. I would invite you to see which story makes better sense of the universe, your story or the story of the Bible, and invite you to explore both of those stories. And I think that you'll find that the story of the Bible has a lot going for it. It actually is the myth come to life.
Today's topic is another that was suggested by one of our dear listeners. If you have something that you'd like us to explore, simply email us at cacg@stjamesglencarbon.org. Much of our best subject material comes from you, the listener. So please let us know what you think. For Pastor Aaron Miller and Production Manager Larry O'Leary, I'm Chuck Rathert.